Trump was a fool to fall for it last time.
Yeah.
Back to your original question. Hopefully he's burned and insulted and resentful against Netanyahu, who's played him like a sucker. What kind of friend plays a friend like a sucker?
Welcome to Just Talk. I'm your host, Hami. Joining us today to discuss the Trump administration's foreign policy vis-a-vis Iran is Scott Horton, the director of the Libertarian Institute, editorial director of antiwar.com, and the host of the one and only The Scott Horton Show. Scott, welcome to this Just Talk.
Thank you very much for having me. Good to be with you.
Of course, excited about this conversation. As you may already know, since you've been talking about this a great deal, a few weeks ago, the Trump administration, it seems, came under strong pressure from Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to support Israel in a strike on Iranian nuclear facilities.
We agree that Iran will not have nuclear weapons. This can be done in an agreement, but only if this agreement is a Libya-style agreement, that we go in, blow up the facilities, dismantle all the equipment under American supervision and American execution.
And the Trump administration, according to the New York Times, waved it away. But currently, there seems to be some sort of division within the Trump administration, in his national security circles, that is, between the Pentagon, the State Department, the hawks like Mike Waltz versus the Tulsi Gabbards. So I just wanted to begin this conversation by asking you, what's your read of what's happening here, and how closely do you think we are, were, to a strike on Iranian facilities?
Okay, well, I don't know for sure. There's a couple of different ways to interpret it. Mm-hmm. I think the most likely explanation is that Trump and Netanyahu have arranged this, and that they're essentially playing good cop, bad cop. And as always, the Israelis are the pit bull straining at the leash, and the Americans are telling the Ayatollah, look, man, just do what I say so that you don't have to deal with him, which, you know, would make a lot of sense. It's the same kind of thing that happened in the Obama years as well. It's part of the crippling sanctions and the ultimate pressure on Iran comply or else campaign, and threatening them with Mad Dog Israel, starting the war without us and dragging us into it and dragging everybody into it, is part of that pressure, I think. And then leading to what? Leading to talks.
Right.
And then negotiating right now. And under this interpretation, Netanyahu doesn't really want war because he doesn't really have a smart endgame for it either. And really, he likes having the Ayatollah there as a threat to the Sunni kings. Why they ought to ally with him against the Shiites and their alliance. So it makes sense for the Israelis, honestly, to maintain the status quo, meaning, or more or less the status quo would be, get Iran back into the deal and America get back into the deal that Obama struck in 15, tune it up a little bit, rename it the Trump deal instead of the Obama deal, and get rid of some sunset provisions and add another paragraph or two here or there, and then try to get back into that. The status quo essentially being Iran saying, we won't make nukes if you don't attack us. And America saying, don't you make nukes or we'll attack you. So that's a pretty good status quo. Just leave it right there. But since Trump, under Netanyahu's pressure in 2018, tore up the deal, or, you know, exited it,
right
now he's got to figure out a way to get back in the thing. And so staving off Israeli strikes is one way to frame it. Another way to look at it would be that, just like every other person in the world, Trump is sick and tired of Netanyahu and his crap. Right. And you got to figure, for a guy like Donald Trump, especially with this second crack at being the president, that he just doesn't really feel like taking much guff from anyone. And Netanyahu is notoriously bossy. You know, he's the kind of guy who would get on anyone's nerves, you know, and bark orders at people who he ought to be quiet and patient in front of, you know. You know, that's what we got to hope for, right? Is that Trump will feel like his toes have been stepped on and that he will end up stopping doing what Netanyahu wants him to do. I think that would be the generous interpretation, which I'm not prepared to commit to at this point. But under that interpretation, Netanyahu was saying, come on, man, let's do this right now. I need your backup. Right. Let's attack Iran. And Trump is saying, no, you sit back and wait. I'm going to take care of this without you. And then he's also, cut this side deal with the Houthis to end fighting back and forth with them. That's the ruling regime in Yemen, to stop fighting with them. Didn't say anything about whether they're going to stop striking Israel or not. So, under that interpretation, Trump is just telling the Israelis, I don't want to hear from you. He's right now on a Middle East tour. He's in Saudi Arabia today, or in Qatar, I think, today. And he's touring Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and UAE, and not Israel on his big tour over there. So you see what I mean, though, how this is all too public and contrived feeling. You know what I mean? That, like, they're playing a little good cop, bad cop thing, which is what I would expect from them to do. It's possible there's a real kind of falling out. I hope for one. I mean, I think anyone, whether you're the president or the secretary of anything, or just mom and dad sitting at the kitchen table, you got to understand Israel's just an albatross around America's neck. There just ain't nothing but bad luck. And they cause us nothing but problems. And just America sans Israel. Let China or Russia carry them around. What benefit does it do the United States of America to be so close with this government? We got to fight their battles for them. The empire fighting for the client state instead of the other way around. And it seems if you're a very transactional guy like Donald Trump, you would just at least sometimes look at it and say, I just don't see the mileage in this. Why are we doing this? We spend all this money, we fight all these wars, they get security, and what do we get? It's crazy to do this. If it was a typical imperial situation, George W. Bush would have called up Ariel Sharon and would have said, attack Iraq and get rid of Saddam for me. Not Ariel Sharon calling up George W. Bush and saying, attack Iraq, get rid of Saddam for me. It's crazy, but that's the way we do it.
There are so many questions I want to ask you. Which of these two stories that you told me is more likely? In a sense, nuclear weapons are the ultimate deterrent. I'm anti-war. If it was up to me, we wouldn't have those. But essentially, if you're Iran and you're here in the US and Israeli officials talk openly about regime change, military strikes, pursuing one isn't very irrational, right? Especially if you've seen what happened to Saddam in Iraq, Gaddafi in Libya, countries without nukes constantly getting invaded and
Well,
regime
and
changes.
you see North Korea not get invaded. They made atom bombs, and so everybody backed off. So, okay, great point. However, here's the thing of it, okay? Iran has clearly chosen. There's just no question about this. And this, it's not a mystery that we all have to wonder about. We know this, okay? And there's lots of ways to know this. Iran has determined to have a latent nuclear weapons capability, which means just like Japan and Germany and Brazil, they have mastered the fuel cycle. They know how to enrich uranium, and they've proven that they can enrich uranium. So once you have uranium enriched up to above 90% purity, uranium-235, that's now considered fissile material, bomb-grade material that you can use in a nuclear weapon. Now, the thing of that is, it's a complicated thing, but just right there, it's very difficult to make an implosion bomb out of uranium. It can be done, but typically, any miniaturized implosion nuke is made out of plutonium rather than uranium. When you think of a uranium bomb, you think of the most simple gun-type nuke, the type that they dropped over Hiroshima, which is essentially the bomb. You think about how big it is. That's because there's essentially a shotgun on one side firing a nuclear pit into another one on the other side of the bomb. And in that collision, they create the critical mass and fission. But the problem is, with a bomb like that, you need an Enola Gay to deliver it. Right. And Iran doesn't have heavy bombers or any kind of means of delivering an atom bomb like that. So, what are they going to do? Put it on the back of a flatbed truck or something? Meanwhile, if they're going to have deliverable nuclear weapons, they would need plutonium. And that's a whole other problem. So, in other words, they did break out and get atom bombs. They probably have one or two uranium gun type nukes, which would be mostly symbolic. It would still amount to a kind of latent capability, even if they had a bomb or two, because what exactly are they going to do with them anyway? Smuggle them to Lebanon somehow? Very doubtful, right? So But then, so what it would take for them to make a real nuclear weapons capability would be to have not just heavy water facilities that burn that enriched uranium and then produce plutonium as a waste, but also they would need the reprocessing facilities in order to separate out all the impurities so that only weapons-grade plutonium remains. And then they would need a lot of testing to and effort to master the ability to do the implosion system for a miniaturized nuke. Then they got to figure out how to marry it to missiles that they don't have. I guess they do have missiles that can reach Israel, but certainly that can't reach us. But they would have to figure out how to actually fit a nuclear bomb into their warheads, which they or into their delivery vehicles, which they've not figured out how to do correctly. So, or at all, right? They haven't begun to try. So their real breakout time to a real nuclear weapons capability is years, honestly. And so the Ayatollah knows this, right? The Ayatollah knows if he just starts making nukes, we're going to attack him before he's done, right? They won't be any use to him because he'll be dead. We'll bomb the whole country. And then, but then the thing is even if he's not dead, either way, whether he lives or survives, lives or dies, then the new regime is going to make nukes. There's no way for America to really accomplish a regime change in Tehran and put another a loyal American sock puppet in there like the good old days. So whoever the mullahs pick to replace Ayatollah Khamenei is going to make atom bombs if we go in there and bomb the place. That's what's going to make them say, okay, well, now we have no choice but to do it. So right now, in other words, the excuse to attack them would be if they make atom bombs,
Which they're not willing
right?
to do.
Which they don't want to provoke that attack by making an atom bomb. Then again, if we do attack them, then they'll make atom bombs. So it's best if everybody not fight, right? It's best when they when I say Brazil and Japan, they've proven that they know how to master the uranium fuel cycle. There's like an equivalent there. There's a metaphor about like having a gun in one pocket and bullets in the other, or maybe a gun in one pocket and a bullet factory at home. Where you've proven you know how to stuff gunpowder and lead into a shell casing and you know how to like pack those into a magazine. Hey, let's not escalate this argument into a fist fight where I start considering whether I want to go home and start making bullets for my pistol I got here, right? That's where we are, right? And then you're supposed to say, you know what? Why fist fight this guy? It's not worth it. Even if he doesn't have a loaded gun in his pocket. He pretty easily could have one, and I couldn't really prevent him from loading his gun. And then I have a real problem, right? So that's the diplomatic message of the latent deterrent is let's everybody freeze right here at this, sort of pseudo Mexican standoff, which is, it's equivalent to the mutually assured destruction thing, right? It's just twisted, right? It's just with a an asterisk, but it's essentially. And so look what happened with North Korea. And so North Korea in 2002, America also named them as part of the Axis of Evil. And they immediately cranked up the pressure on North Korea. They withdrew from the agreed framework. They put all kinds of sanctions on them. They announced the Proliferation Security Initiative, which was their claimed right to seize North Korean boats on the high seas. And they put them in the defense posture review. Sorry, the nuclear posture review, which essentially put them on the short list for a nuclear first strike. At that point, Kim Jong-un said, well, screw you guys. And he left the non-proliferation treaty and six or announced that he was going to. And then 6 months later, left the treaty and kicked the inspectors out of the country. And he started making nuclear weapons. And now North Korea, of course, has far more freedom of action and is a far greater threat to our allies in South Korea and Japan than they ever were before. And why? We took this hard line against them without any plan to prevent them from actually getting that far, right? We were busy invading Iraq at the time. So, what were we going to do about North Korea? All they did was just pick this guy, pick a fight with him to the point where he went home and started making those bullets, right? And started loading his gun. And but we weren't going to be able to get in there and prevent him from doing that. We had our pretext for war, but we weren't ready to enforce it, right? So the Ayatollah. Essentially, at the same time, said, well, look, I'm just opening my books and I'm just proving, sorry to coin a phrase, but hands up, don't shoot. And I'm just proving everyone knows, and our European, your European friends know, we are not making nuclear bombs, and you just don't have a pretext to attack us.
Right.
Saddam Hussein basically tried the same thing in Iraq, but America was just going too fast. There was nothing he could do. He gives up a 12,000-page dossier on his entire unconventional weapons program, chemical, biological, nuclear, from the 1980s and very, very early 90s. Mm-hmm. And Bush goes, not good enough. You must be hiding something, else there'd be 13,000 pages. Whatever. You know
what
I mean?
A million dead people later.
That's right. But with Iran, they weren't going to be able to get rid of that. And they could only do one of these at a time. So with North Korea, they had time to go ahead and make nukes. And with Iran, they had time to just show, especially Europe, that like, come on, man, you guys know that we are not, there's no secret program here. This is the program we've got. It's a civilian program. Don't make us escalate it into a military program. And they've stayed within the treaty. And even after Donald Trump tore up the agreed frame, or pardon me, the
JCPOA,
Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the Obama treaty of not exactly treaty, but the Obama agreement of 2015.
Mm-hmm.
When Trump exited the treaty or the deal, Iran stayed in it. And now they have stopped abiding by some of the measures in it. But that's actually part of the deal, that if America leaves the deal, they can stop abiding by some of the agreements in it without actually breaking the deal or leaving the deal. So that was actually, you know, agreed to by the Americans because the Iranians saw this coming. What if the Republicans come and break the deal? Well, in that case, here's a way that you can play hardball with them without actually leaving the deal. So the point being that Iran still has this agreement with France and Britain, our allies, along with Russia and China and the rest of the Security Council, including Germany. They don't have veto power, but they're like a semi-permanent member, I guess, whatever their status, and the other members of the Security Council, they all signed it, and the deal is still essentially active.
Right.
And so what Trump needs is a way to figure out how to save face and just re-enter the deal. He just needs to call it the Trump deal, the forget Obama ever was our president and sign this deal before deal, the greatest deal ever deal, and then just do it like that, even though he's the one who said this is the worst deal that anyone ever made on any subject in all of history, whatever, which it never was in any way. It was a and I'll explain the deal. What the deal said was, you already have a safeguards agreement with the IAEA as stipulated by the non-proliferation treaty.
Right.
So what we're going to do now is we're going to add what they call subsidiary arrangements and additional protocols to the safeguards agreement.
Mm.
So they were already under the NPT, and they already had a safeguards agreement with the International Atomic Energy Agency. We're just saying, listen, we're going to add a bunch more rules and regulations onto the end of the thing. Where it did before say can, it's going to now say shall. Right. And they just went in there and tinkered with it, basically, and added. And what that amounted to, again, the real point being, because they already had a deal.
Right.
So they were just able to expand on that. But in practice, it was quite a bit, because what it meant was the rolling back of Iran's civilian program. They poured water. They poured concrete, for example, in the Iraq heavy water reactor. They agreed to change the Fordo facility from a production facility into a research only facility. They scale back the number of centrifuges spinning at Natanz by a great degree. And then they added and expanded the inspections regime where they could even go to non-nuclear sites as long as they had an agreement beforehand and could go in there. But, you know, they make it sound like, oh yeah, so they can sneak all the nuclear weapons stuff out the back door, but that's not right. And they can't do that. And they had the Russians and the Chinese agree that if the Iranians are really being obstinate and they're really not giving us access, and we've shown that there's real reason to believe there's some kind of probable cause that something is going on there.
Right.
Then all the sanctions snap back automatically.
Mm-hmm.
And it only has to be a majority vote on the Security Council, not unanimous. And a majority, of course, means America, Britain, and France, right? Russia and China outvoted.
Right.
And so if they don't agree, screw them. The sanctions still automatically snap back into place if America can only get its two closest allies in the world to agree.
Right.
So what's the problem, right? So it was a perfectly good deal. And Netanyahu lied to Donald Trump to get him to tear the thing up and said, oh, he had all this evidence Iran was cheating and lying about their secret program, whatever. It was, of course, a bunch of crap. And so Trump was a fool to fall for it last time.
Yeah.
hopefully, back to your original question, hopefully he's burned and insulted and resentful against Netanyahu, who's played him like a sucker. What kind of friend plays a friend like a sucker?
See, I have a... Every time I hear us, the Americans, talk about, like, Israel played us, Israel did this, like, where is our intelligence community? Where is the people who...
Oh, they know. So well, but Trump is a very special kind of character.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah.
He's a unique one, right? He's not Jeb Bush. He's his own thing. And I'm sure that the CIA was telling him Iran is still inside the deal. Iran's not violating the deal. You know, part of the deal, this was a poison pill the Republicans had added to it, was that the president, no matter who he is, the president has to certify 4 times a year, every quarter, has to certify that Iran is being a good boy and staying within the deal.
Right.
And it's a gold star.
Right.
And Trump is like, what? Every 3 months, I have to reaffirm what a great job the Ayatollah is doing. Mm-hmm. No, I'm not going to, you know, and that was built in, you know, for that reason. Mm-hmm. It was supposed to be a poison pill. The Democrats were like, fine, we don't care. But it was their deal. You know, it was Obama's deal. Mm-hmm. But they knew that if we get a Republican president, that he's going to find that as one, you know, very objectionable reason to try to change it or get rid of it.
Right.
And what's funny is one more thing about this is if Trump had not listened to the Israelis, as far as like what he should do about anything, but if he had taken their concerns seriously, he could have come in and said, look, Ayatollah. And this was, if you remember going back 8 years, this was supposedly the whole marketing campaign of the Trump thing. Right. And this would have, this applied to you and me, and it applied to every foreign leader and including the leader of Iran. Look here, I'm not a Bush or a Clinton. I'm not a McCain or a Biden. I'm Donald Trump. And I'm not even an oil man. Right. I'm like in real estate. I got no connection to any of this stuff, and none of it is my fault. And I don't know you, and I don't care about nothing that you are accused of from before, because I never even read a book about it, and I don't care. Here's the deal. I'm told that the deal my predecessor struck with you isn't quite good enough. But we're getting along good now.
Let's improve
the deal. Yeah. Let's go ahead and get rid of some of these sunset provisions. They say you have to stop abiding by the Fordo restrictions in 10 years. Let's go ahead and make that 25 or ever, right? You already agreed you're not making nukes. So let's just go ahead and scale back the Fordo thing. Let's go ahead and get rid of these sunset provisions. Let's build on the deal we already have.
Right.
And make it. And then by the time we're done, you and I will be friends, Ayatollah. We'll trust each other, and America and Iran can be friends again. As long as we know, you know, we promise the Israelis, we're going to make sure you guys don't get the bomb.
Right.
So just don't get the bomb, dude.
Right.
And then we can be, and then we can be cool, is the rest of that sentence. Right. Mm-hmm. That's what he could have done 8 years ago.
Right.
You know, instead of going with the Israel lobby. But they had his back, you know, financially more than any other thing. And so he owed them.
Okay. And so the core issue, we know that the Iranians have enrichment and reprocessing, you know, dual use technologies. They have those capabilities.
Well, they don't have a reprocessing capability.
Okay. I read some report from like people like John Mearsheimer that they have both the reprocessing and the enrichment. But let's leave that aside. When I spoke
He means like the conversion facility for converting ore to gas, to uranium hexafluoride gas. And then from there is where you enrich it. And then from there, it's not a matter of conversion anymore. From there, it's just a matter of like forming it into fuel rods.
Mm. And so when I also spoke with Ambassador Chaz Freeman, one of the things that he brought up is that one of the reasons Iran wouldn't even want to pursue like building a nuclear bomb outside of like the US is not going to allow that is, you know, religious restraints as well. Not getting into the religious restraints for Netanyahu seems like some scholars argue that like Iran's nuclear program isn't the only issue, and Israel considers any potential of Iranian nuclear capability as an existential threat. Even if Iran never actually uses it or goes to build the bomb, but the mere existence of the capability of building a bomb limits its freedom to act militarily in the region.
Correct. Yes.
And so, you know, it insists on stabbing not just weaponization, but the underlying capabilities. And they don't want the Middle East to, with multiple players with nuclear arms. So the ideal scenario will be that they're the only nuclear power in the region, even though they never come out and say we have nuclear weapons, which we all know they do. So then, what is the end game here? Is it to goad us into a war with Iran, break it up into smaller states like Syria, where like the only super like regional power in the region is Israel? And if that's the calculus, what do we gain?
Yeah, well, okay, a few things there. I don't believe a theocrat. And Chas Freeman is correct. And there's a great article about this by my good friend Gareth Porter at foreignpolicy.com. It's called When the Ayatollah Said No to Nukes. And it's about how way back in the 80s, the mean old Ayatollah Khomeini had ruled, no, you can't make chemical weapons. And his men had put together the precursors. We got a tub full of this and a tub full of that. If we mix it together, we can hit Saddam's troops with it. And the Ayatollah said no. And this is when Saddam is using American satellites to target Iranian troops and Iranian cities with chemical weapons, including nerve gas, sabin and sarin and tabin nerve gas, along with mustard gas and other things. So it was really bad. And the Ayatollah said no, don't. And then the new Ayatollah also said no, forget it, and has a fatwa that says no unconventional weapons of any kind. So no chemicals, no germs, no nukes. But the thing is, like, I don't trust any holy man or any politician. And so when the holy man is the dictator politician who doesn't get to stand for election by anybody, but he calls himself the supreme leader, then like he might as well be a serial killer to me or something, right? He might as well, he has no credibility as a person to me, other than obviously, I understand his position of authority and I understand what his word means to the people below him. So it's clear that when he says no nukes, he means it and they obey him for now. But that doesn't preclude him changing his mind because, oh, guess what? My religion, it turns out it says that we can make nukes after all because America bombed us and now we got no choice. Right, which I guarantee you is what the Quran would say after America bombed Iran. But, oh, look, it says right here, hidden behind the 12th hidden imam is the 12th and a half imam who says, go ahead and get nukes because America's coming again. Right. So that would, whatever. They would, I don't think that religion is binding here other than as a pretension of authority by the government there. That's basically the role it plays. So it means, I don't know. Maybe it means that the government obeys the supreme leader more than they might if he was just some jerk, right? That he claims that authority, but still, like, whatever. It doesn't mean much more than that. It doesn't mean that that's what God told him to say or anything like that. And I don't think the Ayatollahs really claim to be priests in that sense anyway. So that's the first part. And then the second thing is, yes, you're right that Israel considers for Iran to have a nuclear program at all to be tantamount to them having a nuclear weapons capability. They know, again, if they push too far, they will go ahead and make nukes. So where's the line? What's too far? Well, what if they kill every last Palestinian? Might Iran make nukes then? Well, I don't know. Like, let's try it. Right? That's their attitude. They're not sure. But they would like to not have to worry about that at all. And in fact, it's important that in 2012, I'm almost positive. It must have been 12 because Ehud Barak was still in the coalition with Netanyahu at that time. And he was the defense minister. The former prime minister was then the defense minister. And the two of them gave, I guess, a joint interview. I think it was a joint interview to Jeffrey Goldberg of The Atlantic. And they both agreed that they're not concerned about a first strike. Which is what any like anti-Iran, pro-Israel hawk on TV always says is the mean old Ayatollah is suicidal. He doesn't care if Israel drops all 200 nukes that they've got and kills every last body and soul in Persia, as long as he gets to kill Israel because he thinks he'll go to heaven or he's on the side of Satan, made him a promise, or blah, 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 they say.
In other words, we're the only rational actors in this game.
Yeah. So that's why they can't even be allowed to have a nuke because everybody knows They'll just nuke Tel Aviv at their first opportunity, right? West Jerusalem. So in this interview with Goldberg, though, they say, nah, we don't believe that. That's, you know, essentially what we tell the rubes. That's what we had the Republicans tell their voters. But no, in fact, what we're worried about is exactly what you just said. Our freedom of action in the region would be limited. That's a lot of syllables for why I got to fight. Your freedom of action in the region might be limited. In other words, they might want to go out to a full-scale war against Hezbollah in Syria, and they're worried that Iran would intervene, and they're worried that Iran had nuclear weapons, that that would really increase the weight of their intervention. They start, even if they start supplying more conventional weapons or intervene conventionally in Syria or Lebanon, if they're armed with atom bombs,
right,
that does change the equation there a bit. And then, but so what are we talking about? Yeah. Syrian Hezbollah invading Israel? Mm-hmm. No, we're talking about Israel's ability to kill the Palestinians without having to worry about Hezbollah intervening, right? That's what they're worried about. And then their other excuse was there could be a brain drain. We're just talented Israelis say, you know, it'd be safer to live in America. I'm moving to California, bye. And then that would be bad for Israel economically over the long term as bright young Israelis move to the United States or to Europe where they're not under the threat of attack. Right. When the whole point of Israel supposedly is to be a safe place for Jews to come, not a place to bring them all into one small area to target, you know, with immense weapons. So, in other words, they're lying when they say they're afraid of a first strike. They just don't want to have to make peace with their neighbors and figure out how to live in their region other than in a state of perpetual bullying and dominance and threat against everybody else. And so screw compromise. Let's just maintain our nuclear monopoly. And so that's exactly their deal. And as you said, they're worried even about a latent nuclear capability. That's already a threat to their freedom of action if Iran even has the Natanz facility at all. Now, right. So then the question, though, is what are they going to do about it and when? And you know, what are their choices and how certain they are to pick each one, right? I mean, the reality is, as I was saying, there's a competing interest here. Mm-hmm. One, they'd probably like to destroy the entire nuclear program or get Donald Trump to do it for them. They're pushing hard, and all their sock puppets in America are pushing hard for no enrichment. If you can have a nuclear program at all the enrichment and creation of fuel rods and everything has to take place in France, and then they'll give you your fuel rods later. No enrichment technology at all, and I guess burn your files and whatever. and so that's essentially a deal that's made to be rejected. The Iranians are never going to give in to that. But, you know, Donald Trump was, and his, Donald Trump's government has said that repeatedly. But then Trump was asked about it yesterday, and the Wall Street Journal this morning says Trump answered, well, we haven't decided that yet.
Yeah.
So, and I'm telling you, the Ayatollah's never given in to that. There will never be a deal where they just give up all enrichment. Forget it. So right. Trump finally, someone told Trump that, and he's like, I don't know, maybe I still want a deal anyway. That's where we are as of recording this conversation. Things are looking hopeful. You know, the Ayatollah clearly does not want to fight. As we talked about, he already has a deal with us.
Yeah.
So all he's got to do is the same thing again. And by the way, in the JCPOA, the Obama deal of 15, he again reaffirmed and promised no sunset on this. In the deal, says we'll never get a nuclear weapon. Come hell or high water, the UN burns to the ground and all treaties are null and void. We promise still never to get nukes. We don't want them and we ain't going to have them. So that's as good as you can get of an agreement in international law beyond their signature again already to the non-proliferation treaty, which they can withdraw from. This is supposed to be like an indefinite promise.
Right.
So Trump ought to be able to try to figure out how to get back into something like the old deal and claim victory there. Oh, but so in Israel's interest, like I say, they like having the Iranians there as a threat against all the Arabian kings.
Yeah.
Like, why should the Sunni kings all get along with Israel? Well, because Israel's a pretty strong country militarily, and aren't you afraid of the Ayatollah? And that was why America and Israel got so pissed off when the Chinese came and brokered a deal between Iran and Saudi Arabia last year. And which was so funny, like, you got to wonder what was going on. And like, I could just picture like Chinese intelligence guys eavesdropping. Hey, we got some Iranians and Saudis talking about maybe getting along. Like, what if we really got in there and stuck this thing together right now under the Americans' nose? Like, and isn't that funny? Like, what an insane thing for us to be talking about. that horrible treachery of that time that China snuck in and made a peace deal between two countries that America's trying to keep at odds. You know, we've been fighting on both sides of this regional civil war for 20 years, back and forth, getting all these people killed. And it turns out, what, China could just turn that off? Hey, why don't you guys get along? And then, which is another nice way of saying to Saudi, so what do you need Israel for again?
Yeah.
If you're not worried about Iran?
Yeah. We're going to keep talking about Iran, but, you know, like, in a sense, as someone who lives in America, I think, like, there's something to be learned in the way in which the Chinese do diplomacy and the way in which, you know, you can't keep going around the world being the fist that rains down on everyone and expect people to keep wanna liking us and do things with us. That's one reason to be anti-war. If you love America and you want to keep us, you know, safe and everybody's favorite, beyond what Hollywood markets to the rest of the world. But, you know, I've also been following some of your articles and interviews. And one of the latest ones was with, was a yelling match with you and Jonathan Conricus, the former international spokesperson for the Israeli Defense Forces. And at one point, he alludes to the fact that Israel doesn't need the United States to fight Iran. And on the contrary, all they ask for is for our weapons and perhaps diplomatic guarantees. And whenever I'm like reading Israeli media or like consuming what their spokespeople are saying, it's now a talking point on the pro-Israel side. And so if you're an American who supports Israel, right, but you don't want U.S. troops on the ground, you might say to yourself, what's a couple of more billion dollars in weapons contracts, right? Do you see a scenario where we just sit on the sidelines and provide weapons, as we've been doing, if this situation were to go in all the wrong directions? Or is this a scenario where we have to be involved in a very intimate way?
Well, I think it's very unlikely that Israel could accomplish the mission without the United States, being that they don't have any heavy bombers. They only have F-16s and F-35s.
Right.
Possibly they can drop 2,000-pound bunker buster bombs, but or 20,000-pound, I mean to say, but they might need bigger ones than that.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I guess I need to look into whether an F-16 can deliver a 30,000-pound bunker buster and at what range. But it would probably take a lot of them in a row, or maybe helicopters full of special operations troops to drop on the ground and try to infiltrate the place and go in and throw hand grenades at everything and blow it all up, you know, by hand.
Yeah. And like, from
it's
what
possible,
we know,
like you could picture the Hollywood movie of it, you know, being within the realm of like space and time and earthly theory. But like, is that a real likely scenario? Either one of those, really, just successful airstrikes or special operations squads successfully going in there, and then all Israel without the United States, very unlikely, I would think. And if it's going to be such an overwhelming attack that it's going to completely cripple Natanz and Fordo and Bushehr and Iraq and everything, that all of their nuclear infrastructure,
right?
Then I think at that point, the Ayatollah, all chips are down, right? So then he goes to total war against the United States in the region. And tries to just escalate the whole thing, force all our allies to choose sides. You know, we have tens of thousands of troops in Kuwait, Bahrain, Qatar, and Saudi.
They'll all be targets.
And there's at least potentially, right? Yeah. And there's, you know, trillions, uncounted trillions of dollars of economic targets all up and down the Persian Gulf. So the Ayatollah is not a wild guy. But that doesn't mean that he's weak either. I mean, as a leader, he's going to do something. He's in a weak position compared to the United States. But is he going to? And in fact, I should add as a stipulation, you notice most of the time when we have some kind of tit for tat with Iran, they're very restrained. They do like symbolic strikes, even their recent strikes against Israel. Those missile strikes were very restrained, and they gave them hours notice. Hey, we're going to be firing all these missiles. So get your defenses ready. Shoot down as many as you can.
Yeah.
The Ayatollah has to save face. He has to do something. He's not trying to ramp this thing into a real confrontation. He's not the madman that the Israel lobby says that he is. On the other hand, though, you go ahead and it's got to be, I don't know, I ain't never read it, but you and I can't imagine, your audience must agree. Yeah. There's a set of notebooks in the Iranian defense establishment that say, if they ever start bombing us this bad, then we react like crazy, right? Yeah. They have to at some point. They have to attack with whatever naval capability, whatever missile capability, and whatever sleeper cell, you know, underground terrorist activity that they can. And I would not put it past them to have Hezbollah type or, you know, Quds Force recruited sleeper agents in Europe prepared to attack targets. And I don't mean that there have been Ladenites, because they really aren't bin Ladenites, but I'm talking like as fingers of the state out there. And like, this is got to be, it's long rumored to be, and it only makes sense that this would be a part of Iran's defense strategy, and that they would even like that to be long rumored and understood in the West. Right. That, you know what, like, there are guys who could set your forests on fire, who could shoot some cops, who could set, you know, who could do some damage, crash a truck full of gasoline into a group of civilians somewhere. There are people who could cause problems for you behind the lines if you hit us here.
Right.
Now, and then here's one thing that I should always add, and I probably don't enough. British Petroleum has billions of dollars invested in Iranian oil. Thank God. And that should be like, that's your biggest sigh of relief, right? It's like, man, Britain doesn't usually go to war against British Petroleum, right? That was what Greg Palast told me years ago. Britain doesn't go to war against British Petroleum. They've built all this infrastructure there, developing Iranian oil resources as part of the detente of the W. Bush years when Iran was trying to suck up. W. Bush wouldn't let them suck up to him, but Tony Blair would, essentially. And they kind of made this deal back then. So that really ought to preclude it. I mean, that really ought, and it also ought to prove to everyone listening that the Ayatollah might be an SOB, but that doesn't make him aggressive in international affairs, really. If he clearly wants to do business with the United States, and not necessarily at all costs, but the more, you know, the more incentives for international trade that we have, the more counter incentive to violent conflict.
Yeah.
You know, this is why when they did pass the 2015 deal, and Boeing got in there and started selling spare parts for Iran's civilian air fleet. It was like, great, this is what we need, the peace industrial complex, right? Companies who've been banned from trading with Iran all these years now have an opportunity to make billions of dollars trading with Iran. Right. That's what we want. We don't want Boeing making billions of dollars building planes to drop bombs on Iran. We want it the other way around. It could be the other way around. Let's just do that. You know, and
sometimes.
So there's a lot. And this is, by the way, this is what they're talking about. The Trump, if you read the Wall Street Journal about all this stuff, the emphasis on the negotiation is we're going to open up Iranian markets to American goods. Mm-hmm. We're going to sell y'all our plastic crap and you're going to like it. And they're like, all right, fine. And which is smart. And which goes, if you're the Ayatollah, how do you deal with, one, a problem like the USA, but two, a guy like Donald Trump? You tell me, you know what? I bet you'd like to sell Ford trucks to Persians, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
What the hell do I care? I'll let you sell Ford trucks to Persians, but you got to stop threatening to bomb me all the time. Yeah. Like, yes, exactly. This is exactly how you do it. Yeah. You know what I mean? If you've ever lived a life out doing business, haven't you ever done business with people you hate? You talk very softly and you don't fight with them and you exchange money and exchange goods or services and then you go about your way because business is business. Mm-hmm. Ain't no room for emotions in this. Of course you hate that guy. He's the son of a bitch. It doesn't matter. Right. You have to do what you have to do, right? Yeah. He needs money. You need tile. So you make a deal. Same thing with all of these things. We might not, we clearly have many things between us and China that we don't have in common at all.
Right.
But we got billions of dollars invested too.
Yeah.
So let's make that the higher priority.
Yeah.
Our sames rather than our differences.
Yeah.
And build on that and avoid violent conflict.
Yeah. And sometimes we act like we cannot imagine a different alternative and a reality than the one that's been sold to us, that we must exist in this perpetual state of warfare and killing and subjugation of the other. And just to add a little bit more color about what you were saying about Iran's nuclear facilities, the enrichment sites, Fardo and Natanz, we, from the reports that I read, they're heavily fortified and they're built inside of like a mountain around 300 feet underground. And, Israel has a highly capable air force, but the reports that I read showcase that they're not designed to, they're designed to operate locally within and just beyond Israel's borders, let's say Syria, but not like 1,000 mile away in central Iran, right? And if they could get a plane there, they don't have the kind of, like you mentioned earlier, the kind of heavy bombers needed to like carry a 300-pound massive ordnance penetrator, which might be the only weapon that can like reach deep inside and like destroy Fordo completely. And only we, the US, have those, specifically like B-2 fleets. And like I can't picture a world where we're like, okay, you know what, Israel, like you're our ally, so we're gonna give you our
Nah.
yeah.
No,
And
no
so
chance. No chance we're giving them heavy bombers. No way.
And so then, I want to shift a little bit. You brought up China, but I want to talk about the geopolitics, political alliances here, Iran and China. Its relationship with both of those countries are growing. Primarily, one can argue because we keep antagonizing all of those and they keep building these pacts. And we keep pushing them further into Beijing and Moscow's corner and orbit. When you see it, can Iran count on Russia and China for serious support in the
No.
likelihood of, okay,
No, they
and why
can't.
is that?
Well, there's no mileage in it. I mean, from Russia and China's point of view, the cost of getting into a war with the United States
Too much.
is, yeah, it's unthinkable. And over Iran, which has never been very close to either, right? China likes them because they're dependent on their oil. But that's it. They don't have any kind of real special or long-term relationship that I know of. And Iran and the Russians have always been rivals and very jealous of each other and paranoid about each other. Now, Iran is helping Russia fight their war in Ukraine right now by providing them drones, allegedly missiles, but I don't think that the evidence of that ever actually was revealed, just many claims, but certainly with drones. But you don't see Iranian troops on the ground in Ukraine, right? You don't see Iran declaring war and going off to join the war in Ukraine. If America and if America went to a full scale war with Iran, Russia and China would do everything they could to maneuver for advantage. But I can't see how that would ever entail actually what threatening America, you better stop or else. Because or else what? And then what? Now by Thursday, we're all dead. Nobody wants to do that. And they just don't have that much at stake. Comes down to it, screw Persia. China can buy oil from Russia and gas from Russia. Right? Comes down to it. They're just not that isolated. If they lose them, that's fine. And really, from the Russians' point of view, the Iranians are a competitor, right? Like they're also hydrocarbon exporters. So their prosperity is Russia's loss in a sense, not truly, but they would see it, from a national competition point of view. They don't have much to lose if America goes to war with Iran. And as we already established, there's no way America's getting an actual regime change in Tehran. There's zero chance America's going to have a General MacArthur, Viceroy, take over Tehran and build a new regime for those people and reinstall the Shah Reza Pahlavi's nephew in power. Some crap is never going to happen. And nobody imagines it's going to happen except for the Shah Pahlavi's lobby. They have a family and they have a lot of money. They need, an excuse to get more money, that is, but they're never coming back to power there. And neither is the Mujahideen cult, communist terrorist cult, or any of these other wackos. And which doesn't mean that you got to be a wacko to oppose the Ayatollah, because you probably don't. But there are no organized factions of decent people there ready to take over. And if there were, the CIA would come and back them and completely discredit them immediately in doing so, anyway. So, they're. Although, the Ayatollah is old. He's been sick before. Apparently, he's beaten cancer before, but he's pretty old. He's in his late 80s. I think he's 86. Could be wrong about that. I'm pretty sure.
He's knocking on that door.
That's right. So then what happens after that? I don't know if it's entirely clear, like how stable the regime will be after he dies. I think there's, I don't know, probably little reason to think that there's going to be a giant popular uprising against the current order. I could see, you know, massive pressure for, you know, this or that faction, reformist or otherwise, maybe reactionary in the popular elections.
Right.
But that doesn't necessarily translate to a will for a real regime change. Right. You know what I mean? It's like in Syria, they pretend that every time there was a protest, that those protesters were demanding that the president be taken out and shot and his regime overthrown. But that wasn't right. Just because somebody's a protester doesn't mean they want their whole order overthrown. Maybe they were just protesting about one particular policy or set of policies, right? Mm-hmm. I think of all the protests in America, none of which have at their core, or very few, like if you go to the dumbest commie black bloc stuff or whatever, but 99% of all protests in America that have ever taken place have nothing to do with overthrowing the Constitution and the law and starting over with communism or some kind of thing like that. They're much more narrow, you know, protests. So same thing here, where you have some discontent, that doesn't mean they really want to just replace the regime. Like, look at the Green Revolution of 2009, which was sponsored by the NED, of course. And, as they admitted, Obama administration officials admitted that the National Endowment for Democracy paid for all that stuff. But what were they doing? They were pushing for one guy to win the election.
Yeah.
Who was also part of the revolution of 79 and was also a very conservative mullah and was also extremely loyal to the Ayatollah Khamenei.
Yeah.
So he wasn't the guy that Khamenei preferred to win the election.
Mm-hmm.
But was he like an actual, did he represent a regime change?
Yeah.
No. It's like changing the prime minister, but not the president, or the other way around, depending on your system. But you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. You change one, but not the other. And the other is the more powerful one anyway, you know?
And so we're getting close to time here.
Sure.
I want to ask one last question. You're a libertarian. And so, you know, if you listen to the realist scholars, they all tell you, this hyper-focus on the Middle East is a mistake. What the United States should be doing is getting out of the Middle East, wrapping up, washing their hands with it, and focusing entirely on China and containment. Right. And then on your end, as a libertarian, what's the end game here? You know, like, because in the beginning, you began with this fiery, you know, like, information of, like, Israel is getting us into shit we just don't want to be in. So what's the ideal end game for you?
Should
the United States be that too? What direction should do you think the country should be going in terms of like all the mess that we're in right now?
Yeah, look, we should just call all of this off. I mean, I've talked with Walt and Mearsheimer, and their idea is that America should not allow any one power to dominate the Middle East or Europe or East Asia.
Right.
But there's no real concern about that, right? It was just propaganda fantasy that Saddam Hussein was somehow going to, now that he's conquered Kuwait, next he's going to conquer Saudi Arabia and Qatar and UAE, and then he's coming for Syria and Egypt and Iran next, and then he'll be the new Hitler. Next thing you know, he'll be marching on Paris. Give me a break, man. Not in a million years could Saddam Hussein or his great-great-grandsons have ever dreamed of accomplishing any such thing. The whole thing is a hoax. And you got to extrapolate out all this crazy scenario stuff to claim that you're preventing it. It's the same thing with the pretended threat of a German and Russian alliance dominating Europe. Well, so what? It ain't the Hitler-Stalin pact. Right. If Angela Merkel and Vladimir Putin had a strong trade deal and some sort of security arrangement, it's not like they're going to make a new military alliance and conquer the rest of Europe together. Blah, ha, 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 or whatever. This is not the age of totalitarianism from 100 years ago. The whole thing is completely stupid. There's no threat. I mean, think about what America was trying to prevent with this whole NATO expansion, trying to prevent our good friends, Britain, France, and Germany, and maybe the Poles, from throwing together and creating their own European army just to keep the peace, just to, as a security arrangement, to keep war from breaking out. Well, those are all the guys who were always fighting all the time. They wanted to make one big thing together where they're not fighting all the time. We didn't even have to be there at all. That's what we're trying to prevent. We're saying, no, you get to have that, but with us still on top. We'll call it NATO still. It'll be American-led, but then it's exactly what you're talking about. A European, you know, combined army. But of course, at Russia's expense, and in a way that was essentially designed to provoke the kind of reaction that we're getting from them right now. They knew at the time our choice is either erase the dividing lines in Europe or just move them east. In which case, if we do that, we're going to end up with a problem with Russia sooner or later. And then they did that. And then it happened exactly like they knew it would and did anyway. So, you know, that's their attitude. And it's the same thing with a lot of these things. So self-fulfilling prophecies all around. They call out their own mistakes before they make them, and then they go ahead and make them anyway.
Scott, thank you so much for joining me on Let's Just Talk. It's been a pleasure learning from you. We look forward to having you on again and discussing more things like your book, Provoked.
Great. I hope you like it. Thank you.
Thank you so much. All right. Talk soon.